Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording on the 23rd of June, 2013. Nav briefing number 72. I'm calling it, for lack of any other title, The Return of the Repressed. I'm going to break pace a little bit with this briefing in the 70 series. I will return soon to the theme of Persephone and the beauty of Persephone, as well as to the theme of reincarnation, which I promised would be the leading theme of the 70 series in these briefings. But right now, I'd just like to report in to you in the crew on what's going on in the NAV's reality and how things look from the navigation deck. I'd also like to bring you up current with some of the navigational parameters that we follow. You know, I've often said that it could happen in the future that someone will look back upon this experiment undertaken by a handful of human animals at the beginning of the 21st century, a unique experiment in creative mythology framed in the Gnostic intel and the Sophianic vision story. It may happen that some enterprising individual or even a team of people in the future might reconstruct the experiment based on these recorded briefings, as well as the written crew notes. And were that to happen, I am strongly convinced that a fair study of our little experiment undertaken in the future would prove how original it truly is, and will prove also that it was able to stand up against the test of time. Not only that, it was able, it shall have been able, to verify itself. As you know, verification of this experiment is a delicate affair. We look for that verification primarily and initially in ourselves. We find it in the insights and inspirations that emerge as the experiment unfolds. But we also look for it in the collective psyche and in the psychodrama of world events on the whole. I don't think I'd be exaggerating if I said that this current stall is an unprecedented moment in our experiment. I would add that it is a moment that signals a powerful convergence between the experiment and the external reflections of the experiment in the collective psyche and in collective behavior. To put it in plain English, I would say that there is a dramatic parallel now to be seen between what we imagine is happening in Sophia's process of correction and what we can perceive or detect to be happening in the world at large. Of course, there are continuing and massive Earth changes. These are not merely due to Sophia's correction in some general or imaginative sense. They are most certainly due to the earth assuming self-propulsion and self-direction and freeing itself from the capture of the planetary system. I would draw your attention to the phenomenon of sinkholes, particularly the one in Louisiana, which continues to deepen day by day. It looks to me like this phenomenon of sinkholes and collapsing salt domes, combined with the alarming escalation in the methane, in the proportion of methane in the atmosphere, it looks to me like these two particular concurrent events point strongly to what I call the revelation of her method. That is to say, the planetary conditions she now prepares in order to achieve her tulpa. There is, of course, a secondary implication in the manner of it's a massive understatement to say implication here, but there is an implication of these two geophysical changes, and that would be an extinction event, of course. So just because the Aeon Sophia extincts a large part of the human species, it doesn't mean that the experiment has utterly failed and ultimately failed. It simply means that she is exerting her intention to clean up the experiment and to select those elements of it which are viable and worthy of surviving in her eyes and according to her designs and purposes. You know, you don't have to be Nostradamus to see, if you look at the world at all, if you look at what's happening across the planet, you don't have to be Nostradamus to see that we are not going into a catastrophic social upheaval. We are in a catastrophic social upheaval, a planet-wide upheaval is underway, and it can only escalate and become more turbulent, more chaotic, and, I might add, more violent. So in parallel with geophysical changes are these events in the social sphere, in the theater of collective behavior. In all of this, a Gnostic might say, regarding all of this, that you are seeing the consummation of the work of the Archons, and that is certainly a point worth making. I do believe that to be the case. But with the consummation of the work of the Archons comes the collapse of the system of the Archons. It's inevitable that the Archonic system of authority and deception will collapse. The only question is, what kind of world will emerge from that collapse? And how will it emerge? On what terms? What is required for a viable way of life once the Archonic system has collapsed? Reflecting on that question, I'd like to bring in again this theme of the return of the repressed. One thing that you can bear in mind during this summer and during the continuation of the stall into the middle of August is that the Archonic system that has been established socially upon this planet with all its various components I won't enumerate what they are, you understand. The work of the authorities and the work of deceit, false power, and the works of deceit are the signature of the archonic system. So, for instance, the military-industrial complex would be a symptom of the archonic system. The global banking mafia, the global banking mafia, another symptom of the archonic system. And one thing that's certain, and you might reflect on this, is that for the archonic system to have been established and to have achieved the present stage that it has achieved, that is to say, a stage of massive dominance and oppression, it must have required a monumental act of repression of the human spirit, if you will, repression of the anthropos. You might recall that in Not in His Image, in the last chapter, I have it right here, I'm pulling it out. The last chapter was called The Pagan Sense of Life. And I outlined in there the historical moments of resurgence of the human spirit in Europe after the death of Hypatia, the murder of Hypatia, and the onslaught of the Dark Ages. So there was the medieval cult of Amor and the revival of the pagan spirit in the 12th century, leading to the resurgence of creativity and the celebration of human learning capacities and the retrieval and recovery of pagan values in the Renaissance. That was the second resurgence. The third resurgence came with the Romantic movement. And I posed the question, is it possible perhaps that there will be yet another resurgence? Well, as you know, I don't predict, and I wouldn't like to try to predict an answer to that question. Well, there's no need for prediction, is there? Because in the immediate future and the ensuing years, and not too many years, certainly only two or three, the historical developments that ensue and the upheavals and changes in the psychodrama of collective life will certainly answer that question to the mind of anyone who's capable of paying attention. What I can say, however, is that as a human animal operating out of natural instincts, it's possible to feel what's happening in the herd. It's possible to sense psychically and emotively what the great mass is feeling. I don't know about the rest of you, but I have been for some time now, since we entered this stall, laboring with a tremendous sense of fatigue. I think, well, maybe to some extent, you know, there are personal factors involved in that. But I think that also there is a transpersonal aspect. You know, the old expression, I'm sick and tired. Well, I would venture to say that the great mass of animals of the human species, regardless of their level of intelligence and regardless of their ability to read the game of the perpetrators and the enemies of humanity, are feeling pretty sick and tired of what's going on. It's sickening to watch the lies. It's sickening to watch anything in the theater of politics or finance or that realm of archonic control systems. And it's tiresome, terribly, terribly tiresome to be subjected day in and day out to onslaughts from every conceivable angle imaginable, and to be kept in fear constantly, and to be lied to. Just imagine that this was happening in a family situation, you know. Suppose that you belong to an extended family. Say there were parents, children, aunts and uncles, and maybe grandparents. Imagine a large family situation involving a couple of dozen people. Within the family situation, there is physical and emotional abuse, lies, intimidation, and a continual atmosphere of fear and foreboding. But just imagine how ill you would get in such a situation. And this is an exact analog for the situation of the human species right now. And what I sense most strongly as I undergo this intense feeling of fatigue and moral exhaustion is a kind of teetering effect. You see, I strongly sense that the Anthropos, that is to say, humanity at large, which is one way to define the Anthropos, but not the only way, is at the verge of breaking out of the repression in which it has been held. The archonic system cannot succeed without a massive campaign of repression of all that is good and natural in the human animal. But I sense a teetering that occurs just at the moment of that breakaway. You see, there's a feeling of intense exhaustion because at the moment that the repression reaches its absolute extremity, when it is no longer bearable, when its unbearability is no longer sustainable, at that very moment that the breakaway, the breakthrough of the repression is imminent, there can be felt an enormous, enormous sense of fatigue. You know, I recall, this is a simple kind of gimmick, but it comes to mind. I recall a little exercise proposed to me once, which anyone can do. You go stand in a doorway and press your arms out so that the back of your hands and your forearms are against the right and left sides of the doorway, and press, just press. Exert force and press against the doorway. And do that for only 30 seconds or so. And when you then step out from the doorway, and what happens? Well, your arms fly up. But you'll notice that that's an unrepressing action. But you'll notice that as you're still standing in the doorway pressing, you feel two things at once. You feel the tension that wants to be released because you're pressing your arms against a barrier. But at the same time, there is a fatigue in the very act of exerting that pressure. And so the moment of unrepressing, I would say, is upon us, my friends. And the moment of unrepressing may be experienced by undergoing an enormous wave of fatigue, an enormous and heavy wave of physical and moral fatigue. And this is something that I've been feeling, and you can compare notes with me and let me know what you think. There's also an enormous amount of depression and despair in the air. You know, you can lie to human animals front, left, right, and center, as the media does. You can tell them the most blatant sort of lies over and over again. And it is true that, unfortunately, the human animal has an enormous capacity for adaptation. This being so, the human animal has been able to travel all around the planet and adapt itself to many different environments. You know, parakeets and whales and donkeys and butterflies can't do that. The human animal is the only one that has such an immense latitude for adaptation, which is a risk-taking activity in some respects and would be related to the thelete component of our endowment, that we stand out blatantly and flagrantly in that respect. And this huge capacity for adaptation has its negative side effects as well, because it results in a situation where human beings will adapt to anything. This is a theme that has been described many times in novels and films. You know, there are people in the world who spend, people in this world who spend their whole day rummaging around in mass landfills and garbage dumps. And then they go home and live in hovels because they've adapted to that. Now, I myself couldn't adapt to that, but human animals can adapt to just about anything. And so we've adapted to a certain degree, to a huge degree, to the measures of repression that are required for the archontic system to succeed. But even so, at a certain point, that adaptation fails. And it's a good thing that it does. Because when that adaptation fails, the return of the repressed is inevitable. The only question is, how is it going to return? How is the repressed going to return? What is being repressed? And in what manner and form of expression is it due to return? Well, certainly the erotic has been repressed in the human animal. The natural sense of joy and hedonism in sensual and sexual pleasure, the natural aesthetic capacities of the human animal, the attraction to beauty and the love of beauty has been deeply, deeply repressed. The questioning, not just curiosity, but the genuine talent to question and to challenge has been repressed. You know, children have that tendency to question things, to ask why, and to challenge things. The story of the child who observes that the emperor wears no clothes is a continual reminder of that capacity in the human animal to see clearly and to question conventions. And many other examples that I could give. And finally, though, I would add that the natural tendency to fight back, the natural tendency of self-defense has been repressed in the human animal. I was thinking the other day that the situation has reached this point due to the imposition of tactics and structures and authority structures, control systems, and media mind control systems. Due to all those tactics, it's reached a point where the controllers would be the globalists, of course, if you want to put a name on them. Let's say they're enjoying a setup that they have established in regard to the natural self-defense functions of the human animal. They have really got the animal in a corner, and this is the setup. Oh, yes. Do they want to see a violent uprising? Do they want to see violent resistance? Of course they do. But they just don't want to see violent resistance. They also want to see total passive submission. The way that they've set it up, they figure they can win on both cases. They can certainly win when human animals collectively display passive submission and when they just fold and collapse under the onslaught that is directed upon them, right? That's a sure win for the psychopathic control freaks who are in the game of world domination. But on the other hand, as is painfully evident in the United States with the confrontation that is building between the feds and the government and Homeland Security with all of its hollow point ammunition and armored warfare vehicles being marshaled against the possibility of civil uprising. It's very clear in the United States that they also want a violent uprising. And so one of the arguments is, well, don't give them what they want. Well, if you don't give them a violent uprising, you're going to give them passive submission. And in either case, they've set it up so that they figure they can beat either one of those situations. Now, am I denying that there is a middle road between passive submission to the police state, to put a brutal name on it, or violent resistance to the police state? Is there a middle way? I don't think so. I really don't. So the only possibility of a middle way that I would even speculate on is a situation like this, when the structures of authority themselves begin to collapse, then those who would move in against the government and against the archonic system would be able to take to their cause some of the people who are involved in enforcing the system. And they would be able maybe to turn some of the agencies and instruments of suppression against the oppressors. That's possible. For instance, recently there were these massive riots in Brazil, over 1 million people rioting in Brazil. And at a certain moment, the police turned from defending the oppressors to taking the side of the oppressed. So there's a middle way, because in that case, obviously, the threat of a conflict between the police who are defending the oppressors and the oppressed is obviated. And so the option of violence is mitigated. But ultimately, violence must have its day. And the only question is, how is this violence going to play out? Will it be elucidated violence? Will it be directed toward the right targets? The psychopathic control freaks are, of course, counting on history repeating itself. And you know what that means. That people will tear themselves apart and they will exercise exercise and exorcise their violence upon each other, and it will never reach the people that it needs to reach. So it's fascinating to watch the psychodrama unfolding, all the time contemplating the question, will it be different this time? I don't think it will be different unless there is some way to get out to the world at large a message about the proper and moral use of violence and the direction of transpersonal rage and what I have called elucidated violence. So what do these rather generalized and rambling reflections have to do with the particulars of the GNE at this moment? Well, I think this would be a good place for me to go over some of the particulars of the current timing, and as I do so, to introduce you to a key factor in the GNE, which I had not exactly overlooked up until now, but a key factor that has not been widely or consistently considered so far in the navigation process, and that concerns the role of Mars in the correction of the Aeon Sophia. Before I get to the particulars of Mars, however, let me just give you the current update in real time. Today would be day 15 of the Idris shift, and it would be day 54 of summer. Remember that according to the Gaian calendar of the seasons that came to light during the Merida shift, May 1st is the first day of summer. And so counting forward from that day, we are at the 54th day of summer. So the annotation would be S54, Idris 15. You will certainly have noticed that on the 9th of June, a couple of weeks ago, I came out with Nav Briefing 70, a very great fact. And at that time, there was an apogee moment with the lunar apogee entering its stall point into Cancer, and Jupiter at that time shifting just past the Crab Nebula, ready to make its transit between the horns of the bull and pass into the twins. That was the 9th of June. On the 17th came Nav Briefing 71 on the beauty of Persephone. The following day, there was an occultation in Spica. I am going to get around to talking about these, believe me. And in fact, that ties in very closely with the theme of the repressed. So let me just make a note on that, and I'll get back to that in a second. How the occultations of Spica relate to the theme of the return of the repressed. Right now, on Sunday the 23rd, we are looking at a perigee moment. The lunar perigee is in 3 degrees of Capricorn. That would place it in the constellation of the Archer, toward that part of the Archer where the forward hand of the Archer is holding the bow. And it so happens that there's a full moon corresponding to this perigee moment. It doesn't always happen, you know, the coincidence of a full moon and a perigee moment. When it does, you have what? A supermoon. The reason for that being that the moon looks larger because it's actually closer to the Earth. The perigee being the near point on the orbit of the moon, the nearest point to the Earth is its perigee. And it's worth noting as well that this particular perigee of this month of June 2013 is what is called the annual perigee, because it is the one that is annually, one time during the year, the closest of all perigees. So each month when the moon goes through its perigee, or near point to the earth, it is relatively closer to the earth than any other time in the month. But one time, one month in each year, it is closest of all. And that applies to this moment right now. Finally, we're going to see in about a week the passage of Jupiter from the constellation of the Bull into the constellation of the Twins. And of course, as Jupiter reaches the feet of the Twins, what happens? Well, it converges directly upon the stall point of the apogee. So the result is a blockbuster moment that falls one day before the end of the Idris shift. Day 29, that is July the 7th, 2013, there is an apogee surge in 1 degree of Cancer with Jupiter at 2 degrees of Cancer. And not incidentally, at that very same moment, the planet Saturn, which has been retrograding for 5 months, turns direct. You know what that is all about. So Saturn will have backed up or reversed against the order of the zodiac to 5 degrees of Scorpio, which is at the knees of the Virgin. And it reaches a stationary condition there, and then it begins to slowly inch ahead and move ahead in the natural order of the zodiac. So the turning point moment of Saturn coincides with the lunar apogee and the placement of Jupiter in the apogee at its stall. I would describe this as a coordination for the Aeon Sophia between a massive surge of the dreaming attention indicated by the apogee factors and a massive and precise strike of the first attention indicated by the perigee factor. And I would say that this is the first time in the 3 years of correction so far that the Aeon Sophia will have been able to perfectly match and coordinate the operations of her second attention or dreaming power and her first attention, the power of biological and geophysical transmutation or spontaneous generation. There's also good reason to suspect that around the time of Independence Day in the United States, a certain number of human animals might wake up to the fact that they are not independent and that freedom has been lost and freedom is not free. And considering the terrific tectonic torsion and tension that is developing in the psyche of human animals living in the United States, I wouldn't be surprised if there were some dramatic events in the external theater that reflect this monumental moment for the Aeon Sophia, 7th of July, 2013. Just bear in mind what it feels like to be in an apogee moment or a perigee moment. How many times now have we gone through that? Twice a month since the beginning of this experiment. Some of you already know how intense those moments can be. You can pass out. You can literally pass out during an apogee or perigee surge. Or you can be transfixed in a certain manner. The intensity of these moments is undeniable to those who have the patience to observe them, the patience and the determination to observe them. And I'm telling you that you ain't seen nothing yet. What would you anticipate with Jupiter being stationed exactly in the perigee location at its stall? This only happens once, because the next time that there is an apogee surge in that position when the moon is still in its stall, Jupiter will have advanced beyond that exact position, you see. So this is a unique event. And it represents a turning point as well for the Aeon Sophia, the significance of which only came to me this evening as I was having dinner with Gundry down at the train station in San Pablo. One thing about the tantric life is that you don't meditate, you don't do any elaborate spiritual practices that have to be done by taking time off from life. As a matter of fact, the realizations and insights that come most vividly in planetary tantra come when you're out and about enjoying yourself. And this happens over and over again. Remember the Maha Nirvana Tantra. The rites of the devotees of the Ajna Kali are a pleasure to perform. So every time that you are enjoying yourself, whether eating, dining, taking a walk, having a beautiful conversation, having a massage or giving one, communing with your animals, romping in the sexual zone. Every time you're in the true pleasure of being a human animal on this paradisical planet, you're practicing planetary tantra. And in that state of pleasure comes wisdom, refinement, sophistication, determination, sobriety, and consecration. So such is the rundown on current timing. And I must say, if only to repeat myself, simply for the pleasure of it, that even in future time, when the particular and specific conditions of this moment have transpired, those who will investigate our experiment may find themselves stunned by the way it is set up and by the way it is structured according to the real-time events of astronomy and the omens in the sky. And stunned again by how the crew of the GNE applied imagination and empathy to participate in the correction of the Aeon Sophia, moment by moment, knowing what she faces and facing it with her. This is our accomplishment. And everyone in the crew can be really, really proud to understand what I'm saying. Now, I want to give you a quick briefing on Mars, and at some future time to dedicate perhaps an entire briefing to Mars. I found myself wondering the other day about the cycles of Mars retrograde. And I asked myself, wasn't there a cycle retrograde cycle of Mars at some point already since March 2011? The retrograde cycle of Mars occurs when the Earth, which is on an inner orbit within the orbit of Mars, and overtakes Mars, which is on an outer orbit. It's like two cars on a circular racetrack. The Earth is on the inner track. It's moving faster because the inner track is shorter. Mars is moving slower, and when the Earth overtakes Mars, Mars appears to drop back against the panorama of the stars. That is the Mars retrograde cycle. And when that happens, you can observe it because the Earth is actually passing Mars. At night, we are the closest to Mars that we ever get. The mothership skims past Mars. And so Mars is very bright and very close in the evening sky during the period of retrogradation. There was a period from from January the 25th, 2012, until June 2012. So a period of January, February, March, April, May, June. But the concentrated period of the retrograde was from the 25th of January to the 15th of April. So you see, it lasts for about 80 days. Now, it's 40 days from the moment it turns retrograde to the opposition to the sun, when Mars and the Earth are neck and neck, and 40 more days before Mars returns to its normal motion. Of course, it doesn't actually go retrograde. It's just an appearance that occurs in the geocentric coordination of planetary movements. What is really interesting is to observe the part of the sky where the retrograde motion, which consists of about 17 or 18 degrees ecliptic longitude, actually transpires. And in that year, 2012, the retrograde loop of Mars, as it's called, happened in the lion, in the body of the lion. When Mars began the loop, it was toward the hind end of the lion, the hind quarters, and it retrograded all the way back quite close to the heart of the lion, marked by the massive star Regulus. And then it looped back again from 3 degrees separation from the heart of the lion and looped back again through the body of the lion, all of which could have been easily observed in the night sky, unmistakably observed. Once you detect Mars and you identify it, you can see it move backwards against the natural order that planets move through the zodiac. What significance can we attach to this in the context of the GNE? Well, I believe that was the time that I began to develop the formations of the Calico War Party. And I began to talk about the Calico Vow regarding love, war, and magic, and to lead into a perspective of the magical warfare that constitutes the counter magic to the psychological warfare being conducted upon the human species. Two can play at that game, right? And so the introduction within the parameters of our experiment, the introduction to the Kalika warrior theme and Gaian ethics and the right use of violence and right action corresponds to the loop of Mars in the lion. So after I went back and found that, I naturally asked the next question. I knew from a long years of experience in the past when I carefully calculated and observed such astronomical phenomena that the retrograde loops of Mars occur about every 2 years or two years, a little more than every 2 years. So I thought, that's marginal. I wonder if there would be another retrograde loop of Mars before May 2014. Well, you know, folks, Mimetes, it's one of those things that happens in this process. The navigator himself is continually surprised by the things that come up and the granular precision of these parameters. I went and looked, and what did I find? Indeed, there is a Mars retrograde period from the 2nd of March 2014 until the 21st of May. Well, there you go. Remember that the precise date of the completion of the initial conditions of correction is the 1st of May 2014. What do the cosmic omens tell us? What do the astrological movements show? They show that Mars is in retrograde at the time that the 3 years are consummated. It goes retrograde on the 2nd of March in 28 degrees of Libra, and it turns direct on the 21st of May in 10 degrees of Libra. So it goes back 18 degrees through the constellation of the Virgin. Now, there are a couple of things I would note about this prior to a longer briefing, in which I'll discuss it more thoroughly. There are two things about this retrograde loop of Mars which really caught my eye. The first thing is that when the retrograde loop starts on the 2nd of March 2014, Mars has just passed the star Spica in the hand of the Virgin, and in fact is within 3 degrees of Spica. That means that it retrogrades back across Spica again, and then after it turns direct, it passes again, moving forward across Spica. This is called a triple pass. So this retrograde loop includes or incorporates a triple pass of Mars before the star Spica, which is perfectly and beautifully observable in the spring of 2014. Don't worry, I intend to bring your attention to that event again when the moment comes up to observe it. Now, there's a second feature of this Mars retrograde loop, which may be read as a single of the conclusion or completion of the 3 years of initialization. Recall the saying that I introduced at the beginning of our experiment. The correction of the Aeon Sophia takes place in the apsides of Jupiter. Remember that? And remember that in March 2011, Jupiter actually stood in its own perigee. That is to say, the point on its orbit that is closest to the Earth. Excuse me, perihelion. See, I can make these mistakes even after 40 years. When you refer to a planet, the near point on its orbit is called the perihelion, that is the point near to the sun, or the aphelion, the point most distant from the sun. Whereas when you refer to the moon, because the moon goes around the Earth, it's perigee and apogee, the G being short for gay, G-E for Gaia, for the Earth. So, the line of the apsides of Jupiter is the line that bisects the orbit of Jupiter. And at one extreme, the perihelion, Jupiter is at its closest point to the sun and to the Earth as well, within the total framework of the system. And at the opposite point, it is most distant from the sun, aphelion. Okay? What is important to understand is the definition of that line on the ecliptic. And that line is defined by 15 degrees of Aries for the perihelion and 15 degrees of Libra for the aphelion. So as I said, kicking off the 3 years of initialization, Jupiter stood in its own perihelion. Or to be more precise, on the 19th of March, Jupiter was in 12 degrees of Aries. That is to say, it was within 3 degrees of its perihelion. It was shifting into position, locking into its perihelion, as it were. And amazingly, Saturn, the light ship, was opposite, exactly in the aphelion of Jupiter. So that what occurred in the mere 10 days from the 19th of March was an exact opposition of Jupiter and Saturn along the apsides of Jupiter. The correction of the Aeon Sophia takes place in the apsides of Jupiter, okay? How is that relevant to the Mars loop of 2014? Well, the amazing thing is that the planet Mars passes through the aphelion of Jupiter during those three occasions. On the 6th of January and the 20th of April, and once again late in the 20th of June, that's exactly what it does. Now, what could be more appropriate? What could be more appropriate? In some particular manner, Mars falls into place in the total ensemble of astronomical and planetary movements that designate her correction process. And it falls into place at the final and concluding moment. I'm going to have a lot to say about this. A lot to say in the near future. But just let me point out right now that if the first loop of Mars in the Lion designated the moment for the formation of the Calico War Party, then I would guess that the succeeding Mars loop in the Virgin would be indicative of the further activation of the party. The further activation of the party. And most significantly, bear this in mind, take this away from with you, write it on a little yellow post-it and put it on the fridge. Whatever the retrograde loop of Mars in the spring of 2014 indicates, it intimately involves the star Spica in the left hand of the Virgin, the star that marks the mysterious sheaf of wheat. And yes, indeed, that is the sheaf of wheat that was shown by the Hierophant at the conclusion of the Eleusinian Mysteries. So Spica, as you may recall, is the star that represents the entheogenic mysteries. That is to say, the path and practice of shamanism that uses power plants and teacher plants. In some way, that form of shamanism is intimately connected with the activities of the Kalika War Party. And this is to be revealed in the months ahead, and especially in the spring of 2014, by living through that astronomical event in real time. So, moving ahead now, in the conclusion of this briefing, I'd like to return to the main theme, the return of the repressed. Remember that I said that the occultations of Spica, which are now ongoing each month, have been ongoing from the beginning of the year and will continue throughout this year, are connected with that theme. Wow, how is that so? Well, I gave a partial list at the beginning of this briefing, just off the top of my head, a partial and loose inventory of some of the things that have been repressed and that need to have been repressed in order for the archonic system to prevail on this planet in the way that it does. It's not enough. The archons alone can't do anything. They require on repression applied by some human animals upon other human animals. Get that, and get that really clear. They rely also on self-repression. Now, I don't have the quote here from the book Eros and Civilization by Herbert Marcuse. I don't have the book on me right now, but I'll find it again. And you may recall from that quotation that Marcuse referred in the same paragraph to both repression and self-repression. And it's a kind of Russian doll phenomenon, that is to say, a nesting of complexes. So the root complex that drives the human animal into the susceptibility to social oppression and enslavement is self-repression. Begins with self-repression. Then other human animals who are on a power trip or are in a delusional system or are themselves directly managed by the archons, such as the Zadokites, in that case, those human animals who wish to repress other human animals rely on the self-repression of those human animals. And so you have repression and self-repression operating in a kind of synergy, you see? And I noted a number of factors that have to be repressed among human animals themselves, among the population of humanity themselves, in order for the archons to be able to come in and mount their archontic system upon the benighted behavior of a repressing and self-repressing animal. Get that picture. That is exactly how humanity stands in collusion with the archons and accessory to its own demise, insofar as the archons would destroy us simply because they make us more and more like them, and since we can never be like they are, we self-destruct, we end up in total absurdity and annihilation, and they end up with nothing. The archons are going to end up with nothing. Even if they won, they would end up with nothing. But that's the nature of the archons. They're senseless predators. They prey on humanity for the nourishment they receive from human fear and due to being driven by their envy for what we have that they can never have. I want to impress on you how much the phenomenon of repression plays a role in the triumph of the archons, or the triumph that they would wish to have. So I named a number of talents, number of capacities, gifts, skills, call them what you will, inherent to the human animal, which have been brutally and systematically repressed. And let me conclude with two key additions to that loose inventory. Spiker represents the gift of Sophia to humanity, to the human species, the gift of the sacred medicine plants, which are a very particular species. When I say they are her gift to the Anthropos to save it from its own insanity, I want you to mark my words and repeat them to yourselves and make them your own, because this is one of the most important things that I can ever tell you. I will back it up in this way. If you go and read Plants of the Gods by Schultes and Hoffman, you'll find that in the introduction to that book, and every one ought to have that book in their library, by the way, in the introduction to that book, they say explicitly that so far there have been somewhere between 200 and 250 species of psychoactive plants identified, okay? It's a very loose number, at least 200 specifically identified and their properties investigated and cataloged, and they have been experimentally tested. There are millions of plant species on this planet. 200 to 250 species is a tiny, tiny sliver of the totality of the plant world. And as Schultes and Hoffman explain, the chemical and phytochemical properties of these plants, which is exhibited in a certain form of nitrogen fixation and a certain chemical disposition of nitrogen and a certain chemical organization of alkaloids found only in these plants, are inexplicable properties that do not serve the survival or adaptation of these plants. Botanists have not so far been able to find out how the chemistry, the special chemistry of the psychoactive and entheogenic plants, which brings illumination and healing to the human animal, has any value for the plant itself. Take that on board. What does that tell you? When I say that these plants are the special gift of the Ansophia out of her own planetary body to save the Anthropos from its insanity, and that they have no other purpose on their own, as just indicated, then I am stating a very great fact. Another one of those. And so, what has been repressed is human access to those plants. And even when human access to those plants has been allowed, when it has occurred, because people have discovered them and used them, for instance, following the Wasson event in 1957 in the United States, Wasson's Life magazine article on the Mazatec mushroom ceremony of Maria Sabina, even when they have been exposed to the entire world by such an article in a mainstream magazine, consequently leading to the psychedelic revolution, at least some people would say, even then, the knowledge of the correct way to use those plants has been suppressed. So I would say that as regards the wishes of the Aeon Sophia for her magical children, their inability to access the sacred plants she provides to them out of her own body is one of the most, who knows, perhaps the most serious factor in the repression of the natural genius of that magical child. So, bear that in mind, and bear in mind also what the return of the repressed would imply if that factor of repression were to be overcome. That does not mean to say that psychoactive plants and sacred medicine plants would be used by everybody in the world. No. But they would be available to anybody who wished to use them. And they would be available within the framework of a Gnostic instruction of how to use them. And that, to this day, has not been the case on this planet. Although there was excessive experimentation with these plants beginning in the 60s and consistently now for 50 years, there still has not been a system of telestic guidance for their use. The system of telestic guidance observed in the mystery schools has been repressed. And this is not only a very great fact of history, but it is a very great repression in history. And to that repression of access of the mother's sacred medicine basket, to that repression, let's add the point that I raised in my interview with Max Egan. The Gnostic intel on the Archons, the entire spectrum of Gnostic intelligence, and there was an intelligence community that really deserves the name as compared to the CIA and the FBI, okay? The GNO. The GNO was a three-letter intelligence community that really deserves the name, right? In that intelligence community, the knowledge of the archons, the access to the organic light, and the story, the sacred narrative of the Aeon Sophia were the key operating factors, and all three of those have been repressed. And as I said to Max Egan, or to those listening in my interview with Max Egan, there is no item of knowledge in this world, in the scope of human history, that has ever been subject to measures of repression equal to that of the Sophianic vision story, the disclosure of the organic light, the nature of the archons, and the correct use of entheogenic plants. You put them all together in a package, and that package must be really, really dangerous to somebody. Because more effort has been expended to murder, deceive, destroy even the knowledge of the existence of that package, not to mention the package itself, than has been applied to anything else on this planet ever. The return of the repressed has many implications. Certainly, I would be talking abstractly and theoretically to you if I could not prove and demonstrate the return of the repressed in regard to the knowledge of the entheogenic plants and how to use them telestically. Okay? And secondly, and of equal importance, the sacred narrative of the Aeon Sophia. That story and the beauty, inspiration, and power of that story have been repressed. A very great repression, as you know. And now, at this moment in correction, and for the remainder of the 3 years, you can participate with me in the unrepressing of that great and wondrous story and everything it entails. And it would be an appropriate ritual for a Gayan Tantrika and a member of the GNE to celebrate a little bit every day, celebrate with a flower, with a bouquet, with a poem, with a glass of wine, with a beautiful conversation, with a kiss, to celebrate the return of the repressed power of the planetary animal mother and the beauty and vision and healing force that comes with it.